Through the magic of modern media technology, we are transporting you now, dear listener, to Snap Judgment Live. Sensitive listeners are advised. This story does contain explicit language. Please put your hands together for the closer himself, James Judd.
So the first thing that happens when you arrive at Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York is they give you a piece of paper where you fill out your name and the name of the prisoner that you've come to visit. And then they have, you have to explain, you know, why you're there. And there are boxes to check, like friend, family, attorney. And I think, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure who I am in this situation. And there's one more box that says other, I think, perfect. But then there are three lines with the word explain. I don't know how I'm going to explain this in three lines. What pertinent facts can I pull out of this that's going to make sense? It begins in 1998. I'm about to graduate from law school in New Hampshire. And I'm thinking about all the great things that are going to happen in my life and my bright future. I'm planning on being a country criminal defense attorney. And I'm going to have my office in a barn that I've renovated myself. And and I share it with a pack of beagles that I've rescued from laboratories. And maybe there'll be two terribly clever goats. Come, Cooper. Come, Anderson. Oh, you're adorable. Just think Matlock, only gayer. At the same time, I am beginning to obsess over this unfortunate tattoo that I had put on me during a very sort of dark, destructive period in my life. And I wish I'd had the sense to get something, you know, awesome, like a naked lady fighting a dragon or Cher. But it's just this lame-looking flower, and I hate it. It doesn't fit the new, upscale, soon-to-be-socially-respectable me, and I have to get rid of it. Well, laser surgery to remove tattoos was sort of a new thing in 1998, and I find an ad in the back of a magazine for a place in New York City called the Skin Ovations Clinic, and it specializes in tattoo removal with laser surgery. I call, I take a bus to Boston, I take a train to New York, I take a cab to the Upper East Side, I arrive at the appointed time at the beautiful building on 73rd in Lexington. It's an Art Deco building, and I noticed on the little register of names right inside the door that Dr. Ruth works there, so, you know, classy. Even the elevator is fancy. There's vintage mirrors and a bench in case you need a cushy ride up to the ninth floor. And the big mahogany doors have brass letters that spell out the words Skin Ovations. And when I go inside, it's just beautifully decorated with mid-century modern furniture, which in my mind says, we cater to the gays. I like it. A pretty French receptionist offers me eau de glace. Gracias. And then she escorts me into an examining room that's just like any doctor's office. It's all white. It smells like rubbing alcohol. It's got, you know, jars of cotton balls, little metal trays with green towels and pointy things sticking out of them, an examination table. But there in the corner is this big white contraption that I know must be the laser machine, because I've never seen anything look like it, and it just looks terrifying. It looks like it's ready to eat me, and I feel nauseous just looking at it, so I decide I just won't. I'm not going to look at it. Is it still there? I don't know. I don't see it. I remind myself that I am only here for a consultation. At this point, I am not getting involved anymore in anything beyond just talk. And then out of all the laser tattoo removal clinics, in all the dermatology offices and all of the Upper East Side, he has to walk into this one. His name is Dean Fiello, and he looks like a doctor on a soap opera. Who knew you could get a medical degree from Chippendales? Swoopy hair, puppy jaw eyes, his square jaw covered in thick stubble. I feel like I've just discovered a lost Baldwin. His white lab coat traces the outline of his broad shoulders, his brawny arms. He's got a red tie over a pinstriped shirt that melts over his pecs and disappears into a pair of tight black doctor pants. He says something. Something about how different colored lasers break up different colors of ink and yada yada, I don't know. It's so hard to concentrate because he's just so handsome. Did I mention that? You're my last appointment of the day. I was about to close up, but if you'd like to stay and get started right now, I'd be happy to stay. Right now? Yes! That would be great! Absolutely! Yeah, let's do it right now! Great, I'm going to step out of the office. There's something I need to take care of. But as soon as I come back, we'll begin. You can make yourself comfortable on the examination table. The instant he is out of the room, I reach for my belt buckle, I start to drop my pants, and then I remember, the tattoo is on my arm. He comes back in a moment later with a hypodermic needle. He's got a little spring in his step. I think, ooh, great, he's into it. I like that. I'm going to give you some injections of lidocaine to numb the area, but even then, there will be some pain. And tomorrow, and for the next few days, you will be pretty sore. Well, anything good's got to hurt a little bit, right? Lay down here. So I lay down, he gives me about 10 injections of lidocaine, and then he gets a pair of goggles, and he hands me a pair of goggles, and he fires up the laser machine, he gets to work. And it hurts. It really, really hurts. I can smell my skin burning. Do you know what burning skin smells like? Love! His face is so close to mine that I can feel his breath on my neck, and it's making me hard. Listen, I don't care if you're straight. If Superman is breathing on your neck, you're gonna get a boner. True fact. After about an hour, he pulls off his goggles. Every hair falls perfectly back into place. And he wraps my arm up in bandages. He says, the red and the black ink will begin to fade immediately. However, the green ink is going to take some time. How much time? I would say 9 treatments once every 4 months. That's 3 years. 3 years of incredible, intense pain. Okay. I wake up that night, and I'm in a fever, and my arm is on fire, and my stomach is cramping, and I lay there in bed shivering and wondering how he likes to celebrate his birthday, and what kind of car does he drive, and does he like dogs, and what would we look like in matching windbreakers? I don't know why I'm having this crazy schoolboy crush. I'm a grown man. I've been in a long-term adult relationship with all the love and the hatred and the passion, the boredom that comes along with it. And I don't have time for this distraction, but I cannot get him out of my head. I see him every 4 months religiously. And I do everything, every time I see him, to try to move the ball forward. I tell him little jokes, I tell my stories, I try to get personal information out of him. Nothing. The guy is all business. And I think, well, Maybe he's just a shy, retiring medical nerd who doesn't know how handsome he is. It just makes him more attractive to me. But what really makes me crazy is that I just don't understand how someone this good looking cannot want to talk about himself. I mean, if I look like that, I'd never shut up about me. I mean, of course, what am I saying? I'm a mess. I can't shut up about me now. Well, jump ahead. September 24th, 2001, 13 days after 9/11. I'm in New York. I don't live in New York, but Mayor Giuliani asked people to come back to New York, so I'm here. And I've been, right? Well, there were, so I came. And I've been invited by a friend to be his guest at this benefit concert on Broadway of the musical Dreamgirls. And the place is just packed full of famous people. So as soon as the lights come up for intermission, I'm wandering around the lobby looking at the famous people. There's Rosie O'Donnell talking to Luther Vandross. And over here is Scott Wolf from Party of Five. Who knew he was a Dreamgirls fan? There's Chris Maloney. There's Betty Buckley and Patti LuPone are like knocking back vodka shots at the bar. And I see Dean. This is the first time I've ever seen him outside the office. Hey, Dean, how are you? I'm so glad to see you. I'm glad you're safe. It's just you know, there's no words, but I'm glad to see you. Are you enjoying the show? Dean does not react. He doesn't even seem like he can see me, even though I'm standing right in front of him. And he's pale, and his eyes are like black coals, and he's sweating. And I get it. He's high on some kind of drug, but I have no idea what kind of drug makes a person look like this. Are you all right? Do you need me to get some kind of help? The intermission over bell rings and the swirl of people around us picks up speed, and Dean just sort of turns and drifts off. I can't even concentrate on Effie and the dreams because I'm so disillusioned, not just because this object of my affection is, you know, taking some really heavy drugs, but just that I pride myself on being a person who can read people. And this time I was just so wrong. So the next day I leave a message on the answering machine canceling my appointment, and I never go back again. Jump ahead. It is February 2004. I am in Los Angeles. I have a soy latte, and I have a little table outside on the sidewalk in Santa Monica Boulevard. And I sit down, and I notice that somebody has left behind a copy of the New York Post. It's very unusual to see a New York Post in L.A. So I flip it over, and there on the cover is a picture of Dean Fiello under the headlines, "Cops Hunt for Killer Quack." Turns out he's not a doctor. He's a construction worker with no medical training whatsoever. That's not the big news. He's already been busted for stealing prescription pads and supplying his own synthetic morphine habit, this drug called Stadol, which apparently you could give like a pregnant lady one squirt and poof, they pop out a baby, right? He's apparently going through a bottle a day. That's not the big news. The police have found the body of one of his patients, stuffed in a suitcase, buried under the cement floor of his garage in New Jersey. Her name was Maria Cruz. She was a 35-year-old investment analyst for Barclays. She went missing on April 13th, 2003, and the last notation in her day planner was a Sunday early evening appointment with Dean Fiello. Meanwhile, Dean is missing. He is nowhere to be found. Also, according to the Post, which is all over this story, he has been rumored to have been seen in San Jose, Costa Rica, working as a naked go-go boy in a gay disco. I read this, I think. This is horrible. And then I think, well, how much does it cost to go to Costa Rica? The story is all over the tabloids. Everybody covers it. The New York Times, the Daily News, the Post. People Magazine does a whole story on it. 48 Hours Mystery does an entire hour. Even Vanity Fair publishes an 8-page expose on his playboy life before he became a fugitive. Far from being a retiring medical nerd, he is a notorious Lothario who has left a string of broken hearts across Manhattan. Well, by this time, I think I don't have any more capacity to be shocked by any of this. Until I come across this line. The handsome playboy had a well-known reputation for partying with his patients! You fucker! Jacques. Dean Fiello was eventually captured at a pool bar at a resort in San Manuel Antonio El Capitan, Costa Rica. He spends 15 months in a Costa Rican prison. They bring him back to the U.S. in chains, and then he spends 19 months in Rikers Island. And then he accepts a plea deal, which sends him to Attica for 20 years. That, I think, is the end of that. But there's more. Jump ahead. January 2012. You know, right now, I don't know whether I should finish my story or sing Over the Rainbow. I don't know what I'm going to... Do we have clearance? No clearance? No, we can't get clearance for that? All right. January 2012. I am living in San Francisco. I'm married to a guy named Eric. We have a couple of dogs. We have a house. We have a business together, and life is great. I know that's a lot of time compression, but this is radio, and the clock's a-ticking. And frankly, aren't we all just really jonesing for a drink about now? The band's got to play their last set at the subway at 53rd and Lexington. They need their getting home money. Yeah. Anyway, there is a new story on the news about a fake doctor. And this time, everyone in the news media, and by everyone I mean Nancy Grace, is blaming the victims. Oh, how could they not know? How could they not know they were a victim of a fake doctor? Blah, 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 blah. And I start to think, well, maybe I ought to tell my story about how I was the victim of a fake doctor. And then I start to think, I wonder what Dean Fiello would say about what he did if I had a chance to ask him. So I write to him. And I don't really think that he's going to write back, but I figure if he does, or even if he doesn't, it'll make a nice little wrap-up to my anecdote about the time I had a brief 3-year obsession with someone who turned out to be a famous killer. But he does write back. He writes page after page after page of grief and remorse and shame and humiliation. 20 pages in all handwritten on line notepads, note paper. And behind it is a 12-page story he has written about the day that woman died in his office. And this is from the end of that story. I caught a glimpse of myself in the wall mirror. Puffy, sleep-deprived eyes stared back at me. I took another hit of coke. I couldn't get through a single day without medicating myself. Cocaine for energy, morphine for the long hours spent hunched over patients, tense, sweaty, laser in hand, Ativan to level it all out. As soon as I walked back in the treatment rooms, I knew something was wrong. White foam filled the interior of her mouth. Panic seized me like a bear's claw. I shoved the laser away from the table, smashed it into the wall. I checked for a pulse. I felt nothing. I started CPR, still nothing, and I knew she was gone. My day of reckoning had arrived. So I write him back. I say, send me another story. And then they start coming, you know, one, two, sometimes three a month. And I like it. I like having a prison pen pal. There's something very Jane Austen-y about getting a handwritten letter in 2012. It's sort of like, you know, Mr. Darcy goes to solitary. Poor Lydia is buried in the garage. Ooh, what will happen next? And so after about a year of writing to each other, I decide to go see him. At the visitor center, I check friend, and I immediately feel weird about it. And a guard escorts me to the visitor's room. He gives me a table. He tells me where to sit and wait for my prisoner to arrive. And the visitor's room looks nothing like I expected to. On one wall, there are giant murals of orcas swimming through the ocean. And over here on the ceiling, there are eagles flying free. And there's a bank of vending machines filled with stuff that the prisoners can't get in the commissary. And prison wives scooping out armloads of sodas and chips and salad and sandwiches. And there are people playing games. There's some kids running around. There's a charismatic minister making the rounds, shaking hands, cracking jokes. But it's relaxed, you know, it's calm. It's just like an ordinary day. And then out of all the visitors' rooms and all the maximum security prisons in all of America, he walks into this one. Dean Fiello. But he's changed. Much smaller, thinner, gray hair, glasses. He approaches the table, we shake hands, and there's a moment where we look at each other, really look at each other for the first time with our eyes open and our minds clear, his free of drugs and not hiding behind a fake persona, and me not feeling like I need to entertain him every minute just to get his attention. But also behind those eyes, I realize that he doesn't remember me. So I say, now that I'm here, do you remember me? He says, no. So I roll up my sleeve and I show him my tattoo. He says, oh yeah, the green was really hard to get out. There's a couple of minutes of chit-chat and then I just start firing questions away. What made you think you could get away with this? Who helped you get the drugs? When did you start using them on yourself? Why morphine? Where were you when you knew that the police were looking for you? Why did you go to Costa Rica? Why didn't you go to Rio or Brazil where you could have blended in easier? Did you know there was a story about you in Vanity Fair? Where were you when you caught? How did you survive in the prison in Costa Rica if you didn't speak Spanish? And I wish I could tell you all of the things that he said to me, but I can't. I don't have time except to say that I used every weapon in my arsenal to figure out whether or not he was lying to me, and I don't believe that he was. If I had believed he was lying to me, I would have ended it there. But I think he was telling me the truth. So I said, I want to talk about the day that woman died in your office, because the way you wrote about it in your story, I don't think it happened that way. Because I did some research online on death by lidocaine, and it doesn't happen the way you wrote it, quick. In fact, it takes a really, really long time for someone to die of an overdose of lidocaine, long enough that you had time to call someone for help. I called a friend who was a doctor. And what did he tell you to do? He told me to hang up and call 911. And what did you do? I hung up. But you didn't call 911. And the medical examiner said that you had. That woman probably would have lived, so why? Why didn't you call 911 when you had a chance to save that woman's life? I don't know. The most honest answer I can give you is, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't do it. Panic, fear, shame, I wish I had. I ask myself that question every day. A bell rang and people got up and started getting ready to leave. So I stood up and I reached out my hand to shake his, and he reached over and embraced me, and it was awkward. And when I broke free, I said, listen, I went through your case file and I found something that might get you out of here a little bit early. It's not a reduction in sentence. It's just that the time you spent in jail in Costa Rica should have been applied to your sentence here. It's a technicality. I'll follow up on that. So, anyway, he said, James, before you go, I want to tell you something. You asked me earlier if I'd had many visitors, and the fact is I haven't had any. You're the first person who's been here to visit me in the 8 years since I arrived at Attica, so thank you for that. Oh. Well, I'm glad I came. As soon as I get to the parking lot, I'm completely disoriented to be out in the light, and I'm wandering around trying to find my rental car, and a guard, the one who showed me where to sit in the visitor room, passes me and he says, "You get what you came for?" Yes. No, maybe, I don't know. Is the obsession over with? I think so, but I'm still talking about it. I mean, here I am, right? And we're still writing to each other almost every month. I can't forgive him for what he did to Maria Cruz or any of the other people that he conned. That's not my place. But I do forgive him for what he did to me. And I do consider him to be my friend. And I still have half a tattoo. And I'm keeping it.
James Judd, ladies and gentlemen. The original score for that piece was by Alex Mandel, performed by Alex and the Snap Players, Tim Frick, and David Brandt. You can see and feel and share this performance in vivid Technicolor glory. Simply go to our website, snapjudgment.org, watch the video of this performance right now. Trust me, you've got to see it.